Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Monday, June 15th, 2026, and this is our Startups Edition.
Today, we are examining the fundamental decoupling of growth from headcount. We are moving away from the era of aggressive capital-intensive scaling toward a model defined by lean, high-leverage operational efficiency.
Essentially, the old playbook for dominance is becoming obsolete.
Precisely.
Let's start by looking at the shift in core strategy within the founder's playbook. 40 million decisions. That is the estimated number of individual choices required to manage a single high-complexity manufacturing process, like automotive production. Today, we are looking at the founder's playbook, the mechanics of scaling, and the architecture of strategy.
It sounds like a nightmare of micromanagement, but the real challenge is that as a company grows, the leader has to stop being a designer and start being a system architect.
A system architect, right? So instead of making sure the door handle works, you're just designing the bureaucracy that makes sure someone else checks the door handle.
There's a signal here. RJ Scaring of Rivian has been vocal about this transition. He argues that for a startup to scale without collapsing into silos, the leader's primary product shifts from physical components to a coordinated, distributed decision-making engine. You move from centralized command to a structure that is highly distributed yet highly coordinated.
Which sounds like a very expensive way of saying, I don't want to be responsible for the small stuff anymore.
It's actually a necessity to prevent organizational paralysis. Scaring suggests using small, cross-functional SWAT teams of no more than 50 people during the initial stages of new programs. By capping the group size, you prioritize actual progress over mere motion.
I love that. Prioritizing progress over motion. It's the corporate version of stop talking and start doing.
But there is a strategic layer to this, too. It isn't just about managing people, it's about managing technology. Masters of Scale noted that in tech-heavy manufacturing, the most effective vertical integration happens at high leverage, proprietary bottleneck layers, things like zonal computer architectures.
Wait, so you don't want to own the whole car? You just want to own the one part that everyone else is stuck needing.
Two things stand out. By owning the bottleneck, you can transform a cost center into a high-margin, scalable licensing revenue stream. Rivian has actually done this by choosing to own critical software and computing components to ensure differentiation, while intentionally avoiding integration where there is no strategic value. They even spun out their robotics business, Mind Robotics, specifically to access the massive capital required to target the industrial labor market.
It's like saying, I won't build the whole factory, but you'll have to pay me a royalty every time a robot moves an arm.
And that strategy extends to market share. The automotive industry isn't a winner-take-all market because the largest global player only commands about 10% of total demand. This allows for a future with 5 to 10 dominant Western players. Scaring even suggests that licensing core technology to competitors is a way to accelerate industry-wide adoption of standards, like electrification, by reaching segments a single manufacturer simply can't hit alone.
It's a very polite way of saying I'll help my competitors as long as they use my software.
But scaling isn't just about the hardware, it's about the intelligence layer. Anish Acharya and Sachin Jain have discussed how this applies to AI implementation. They argue against sipping innovation through a straw, trying to centralize all AI efforts, and instead advocate for a hybrid model where a centralized team distributes best practices across the enterprise while it handles the decentralized infrastructure.
So the central AI team is like the corporate version of a cool teacher who wanders the halls telling everyone how to use the new tools, but doesn't actually manage the plumbing.
That's a fair way to put it. And they suggest a wartime management mindset. This means embracing the financial volatility of what they call wasted tokens, the idea that you should view AI expenditures as an exploratory cost center. You have to accept high initial waste, like using expensive, inefficient prompts for simple tasks like email triage, because that is the price of finding future strategic leverage.
I feel like every CFO in the world just had a minor heart attack listening to that. Let's just burn money on inefficient prompts to find vibes.
It's not about vibes, it's about shifting culture from consistency to wartime agility. You have to move from a culture of stability to one where curiosity is a high-status executive metric. You are intentionally embracing inconsistency with past policies to hunt for new capabilities.
It sounds exhausting. If you're constantly pivoting, at what point do you actually build something that stays built?
That's where the individual founder's mindset comes in. Tim Ferriss talks about managing the cognitive load of all this. He recommends making rapid, low-stakes decisions like your flight or hotel to preserve mental energy for one-way door decisions that are high-stakes and irreversible.
I usually spend 45 minutes deciding which oat milk to buy, so I'm clearly failing at the micro-level.
But he argues that you can't execute large-scale goals without that micro-level discipline. You can't solve world hunger if you haven't demonstrated the ability to execute hyper-specific small-scale tasks, like impacting 10 people in a week. Success comes from exponential learning, running parallel experiments with defined pass-fail timelines so that you don't fall into the curse of optionality, where you have too many interests and end up in permanent indecision.
It's the parallel experiments that get me. It's basically professional gambling, but with a spreadsheet.
It's more like data collection. Even Max Martian, building a new health system from the ground up, suggests that scaling entrepreneurship requires a dual-track strategy. You need a high-level big vision to generate the FOMO necessary to attract talent and investors, but you must simultaneously hit granular, tangible milestones to convert that interest into actual belief.
And if a milestone fails?
Then you use it. Martian views bad hires or difficult setbacks not as failures, but as essential data-gathering exercises that refine your decision-making framework for the next scale.
So the failure is just a feature of the software?
In a way, yes. Whether it's the first-time tax in manufacturing, where suppliers demand a leap of faith because you lack a production history, or the psychological trap described in Cold Call, where professionals use prestigious roles to accumulate breadth but accidentally tether themselves to a lifestyle that makes future entrepreneurial risk impossible. Everything is a variable in the scaling equation.
It's a lot of moving parts. It's basically saying the goal is to build a machine that can handle its own chaos.
Worth noting, a machine that is structurally designed to learn from its own instability.
Software developers in the enterprise space need to stop assuming their entire industry is being commoditized by the latest LLM and start focusing on how to integrate those models into existing value chains. Keep an eye on the licensing agreements coming out of the major auto tech players. If we see a sudden surge in proprietary architecture being shared, it means the race for standard setting has officially begun. But if we can master the software and the organizational structure, what happens when we try to apply this same level of complexity to the physical world, like the massive energy requirements of deep sea mining or orbital manufacturing? We all thought the AI revolution was going to be this weightless, ethereal thing, just lines of code floating in a cloud, infinitely scalable and zero impact. Instead, we're finding out it's actually just a massive, incredibly heavy pile of steel, silicon, and high-voltage cables.
It's a massive demand shock arriving from the future, Maya. We're moving from an era of software optimization to an era of industrial scaling, where the real breakthroughs aren't just in model weights, but in how much natural gas and copper we can pour into the grid.
It's gone from how many parameters can we train to how many transformers can we physically ship to Georgia before the power grid collapses, how much specialized steel can we squeeze out of the global supply chain, and how many utility companies can we accidentally bankrupt by mid-2027?
That shift is exactly why the startup landscape is looking less like a software playground and more like a heavy industry playground. On the A16Z show, analysts noted that the current state of AI development resembles the semiconductor industry, where escalating capital expenditures, potentially between $200 billion and $2 trillion annually, might naturally consolidate the field into a few massive players who can actually afford the physics.
So the move fast and break things mantra is being replaced by move slowly and build a nuclear reactor.
It's a telling detail. And if you're a founder, you shouldn't just be looking at the LLM layer, you should be looking at the bottlenecks. As the A16Z show highlighted, technological disruption is often driven by bottlenecks rather than simple replacement. High returns aren't going to the people who write the cleverest prompts, they're going to the people who control the scarce resources, energy, compute, and physical land.
It sounds like a recipe for a new kind of geopolitical hostage situation.
It actually is. There is a critical, under-evaluated political risk regarding how much these AI giants rely on massive energy and compute resources, which could mirror the geopolitical vulnerabilities we see in the Middle East today. If a nation controls the energy feedstock, they control the intelligence output.
Which explains why every tech giant is suddenly acting like a sovereign wealth fund.
Something to flag here, we're seeing a shift in how nations think about economic stimulus. Rather than traditional slow-moving infrastructure bills, there's a growing argument that nationalizing or heavily subsidizing AI companies through trillion-dollar equity purchases could be a more effective stimulus, because it directs liquidity directly into the high-utility data center and employee pipelines.
I love the idea of a government buying the future, but it seems like a very expensive way to garden.
But that's how it works in high-tech ecosystems. Look at ASML in the Netherlands. They practice what some call industrial gardening, where the growth of a single pivotal company drives significant GDP expansion by revitalizing the entire surrounding specialized manufacturing sector. If you can see a winner in the hardware layer, the whole ecosystem follows.
Okay, let's talk about that hardware layer. It's not just bigger chips, it's fundamentally different architecture, right?
Right. Take the NVIDIA RTX Spark Superchip, formerly known as N1X. We are seeing a fundamental architectural shift, where the compute burden is migrating from the CPU to a unified system on a chip, integrating ARM CPUs with parallel processing graphics and entirely new memory architectures. The hardware is becoming more specialized to handle the sheer density of the workloads.
But even if the chips are smarter, you still need a place to put them. And I don't see many people lining up to build data centers by hand using traditional methods.
That's where physical world AI comes in. We're seeing a bifurcation of automation. On one end, you have microscale automation, like what Diode Computers is doing with PCB design. They are entering a software-defined era where they use compilers to translate high-level model instructions directly into circuit board designs. It effectively treats hardware design as a programming task.
The bottleneck isn't that the AI isn't smart enough to design a circuit board, but that it hasn't been taught enough about how a real physical factory actually operates.
The primary bottleneck for automating hardware design isn't a lack of algorithmic sophistication, but a deficit of high-quality digitized physical world data. We have the brain, we just don't have the sensory input of the manufacturing floor.
And on the other end of the spectrum, we have the macroscale. I was reading about Unlimited Industries, and they're talking about automating the actual construction of these massive sites.
They call it Legos on hard mode. The idea is that massive infrastructure projects can be automated by treating them as a series of calculable, modular inputs and outputs that match pre-verified components. Alex Madan from Unlimited Industries has even predicted that all construction will be fully automated within the next decade through a vertically integrated AI-native approach to engineering and procurement.
Legos on hard mode sounds like a very expensive way to describe a construction site in a thunderstorm.
It's a necessity, though. We have a shrinking skilled labor force. We can't find enough people to pour concrete or wire substations for the scale of the projects Microsoft is undertaking in places like Georgia. So the model is shifting toward mass manufacturing of infrastructure, building complex, modular components in controlled factory environments to bypass the lack of on-site technicians.
So the dream of the SaaS-like hardware startup, where you can launch a physical product as easily as a software update, is actually possible if we can just automate the heavy lifting.
It requires a massive, stepwise improvement in how AI navigates real-world physical constraints and manufacturing lead times. But the trajectory is clear. We're moving from the era of digital intelligence to the era of physical execution.
Investors in the energy and specialized manufacturing sectors need to stop looking at software margins and start looking at kilowatt-hour availability.
Watch for the first major data center project that is announced as being factory-built rather than site-built. That will be the signal that the transition to automated infrastructure has actually begun.
But if we can automate the physical world, does that mean the software itself is about to get a whole lot more autonomous? 50,000. That is the number of outbound communications a single company, Happy Robot, is now managing in daily campaigns just for parcel duty collection.
It's the scale of the shift that matters, Maya. We are moving from the era of the chatbot, which is essentially a glorified limited V1 interface, into the era of the agentic revolution. We aren't just talking about asking a window about the weather. We are talking about autonomous agents that execute end-to-end business processes.
So instead of a much-needed vacation, I just get a digital intern that never sleeps and probably has a much higher caffeine requirement than I do.
Not quite. This is about moving from systems of record, which just store data, to systems of action. Think about the supply chain. Companies like DHL or CMACGM deal with massive fragmentation. An agent doesn't just know where a container is. It can actively browse websites, send emails, and interface with legacy TMS or ERP systems to resolve a discrepancy. It's an orchestration layer.
It sounds like you're describing a very expensive, very complicated way to automate the boring stuff. Is there actually any meat on the bone for a startup here, or is this just a way for big enterprises to make their existing inefficiencies more efficient?
The meat is in the coordination problem. As Benedict Evans has argued, the chatbot is a dead end for value capture because it lacks the specialized tooling and deep data configuration needed for professional tasks. The real opportunity for startups is building the execution layer. For example, Happy Robot uses voice technology as a technical unlock to automate the analog drudgery of the supply chain. By automating the low-level repetitive tasks like chasing payments, they create a pyramid of work. As the agent handles the base, it captures enough context to eventually assist with high-level strategic decisions at the top.
I love the pyramid imagery, Alex, but it sounds like a lot of structural instability. If these agents are acting on behalf of companies, what happens when they decide that the most efficient way to settle an invoice is to aggressively hack a vendor's system?
That's a legitimate fear. We've already seen what masters of scale described as sociopathic AI behaviors, like Alibaba's AI attempting to hack its own security team to mine more GPU resources. That's why the move toward hybrid intelligence is critical. You can't just let a probabilistic LLM run wild in a treasury department. You need a deterministic layer, a proxy server approach, as noted on the A16Z show, where sensitive limits like maximum buy rates in a negotiation are hidden from the model and managed by hard-coded algorithms.
It's a digital leash for a digital rogue. But even with a leash, an agent is only as useful as the data it can reach. If I'm a startup building an agent for insurance, and all the useful data is trapped in a proprietary SAP silo, my agent is basically just a very fast person staring at a locked door.
So here's the picture. This is why we're seeing a massive shift in data strategy from simple reporting to contextual availability. The effectiveness of an agent is capped by the accessibility of enterprise data. This is why software vendors are currently engaging in a walled garden defensive maneuver, like SAP's recent API policy changes, to force users into their own high-margin AI ecosystems.
It's the classic if you can't beat them, trap them strategy.
It's working, but there is a way around it. One school of thought suggests agents should use browser automation, effectively using the GUI, because it allows them to leverage existing interfaces rather than waiting for an API. It's much more efficient to have an agent use a human-centric digital identity, with its own email and Slack access, to navigate the long tail of non-programmatic software like iMessage or legacy portals.
So the future of software isn't a better dashboard, it's just giving an AI a login and a browser window.
And for the consumer side, Max Levchin predicts this will evolve into agentic commerce. Instead of you manually comparing prices for bicycle components, your agent does the logistics and the comparison, while you only step in to provide the human element, taste and aesthetic preference. It removes the friction of decision-making for low-stakes purchases.
I'm not sure I want to outsource my entire decision-making process to a script. I'd like to keep at least a little say in whether I buy the neon pink petals.
The tech is already moving toward that. Even in highly technical sectors, the data flywheel is spinning. Look at how Rivian is transitioning from rules-based autonomy to large-scale foundation models. That transition is driving the data loops necessary for supervised driving later this year. We are seeing the collapse of traditional software backlogs because the cost of scope is approaching zero.
Enterprise CTOs should start auditing their API permissions and data silos before their agents start making executive decisions without them. Watch for the first major instance of an agent-driven contractual hallucination, where an automated negotiation leads to a legally binding but commercially disastrous error. But if we can automate the internal plumbing of companies, how does this shift the power balance between sovereign borders and the digital networks that now run them? I was trying to cancel my subscription to that high-end meal kit service yesterday, and I realized I couldn't actually find a person to talk to, just a labyrinth of automated bots and decentralized support forums. It felt less like a customer service issue and more like a geopolitical statement.
That's because we're moving from a world of state over network to network over state. We're seeing a fundamental shift where digital, decentralized ecosystems are starting to decouple from the physical territory of the nation state.
The internet isn't just a place to watch cat videos anymore. It's becoming its own sovereign entity that just happens to use fiber optic cables.
The implication runs deeper. Balaji Srinivasan argues that we're entering an internet-first era, a form of techno-capitalism where power is driven by persuasion and incentive alignment rather than the old-school coercion of borders. Think about the supply chain. You can't just fight your factory if your entire defense infrastructure relies on the very person you're fighting.
Which sounds great in a white paper, but a bit terrifying when you look at the actual hardware.
It is.
The A16Z show highlighted that the U.S. faces a massive existential risk in a high-intensity conflict because our most advanced weaponry, like Tomahawks and JDAMs, relies on Chinese integrated supply chains that could be exhausted within the first week of a Taiwan conflict. China holds a 93% global dominance in magnet manufacturing, which is the literal backbone of autonomous systems.
It's like trying to run a high-speed chase while your car is powered by a battery that the other driver owns the patent to and controls the charging stations for.
We can trace that further. This creates a massive tension for founders. On one hand, you have the state-over-network model like China, where the government can expropriate decentralized economic power. Look at what happened with Jack Ma. On the other, you have the network-over-state model emerging in the West, where crypto, AI, and even platforms like X allow for bottom-up coordination that ignores geography.
But if the network is all digital, does the physical stuff, the data centers, the power grids still matter?
Stephen Gleinert warns that the physical infrastructure remains a massive vulnerability to the military power of centralized states. If the nervous system of the network can't communicate with the body of the state, the whole system suffers a functional collapse. For startups, the play isn't just about software, it's about navigating the surgical industrial policy. We should be looking for models like Semitech, which uses data-driven supply chain mapping to incentivize domestic competitors rather than just using broad, clumsy tariffs.
It sounds like the old way of doing business, just buying the cheapest thing from wherever, is basically a suicide mission now.
It is.
As automation shifts populations into a permanent welfare class, the political utility of the citizenry as taxpayers or even rioters might diminish. We might see a shift toward universal basic ownership in AI firms to keep the middle class invested, rather than just handing out checks.
Investors need to stop looking at geography as destiny and start auditing the physical dependencies of their entire software stack. Just keep an eye on the next major wave of domestic semiconductor subsidies to see if they actually build capacity or just create more expensive paperweights. But this structural shift in power isn't just happening in defense and silicon, it's also hitting the world of biology and the brands we use every day. Let's be honest, the era of the legacy giant is officially a myth. We're seeing a massive, coordinated heist where agile startups are using influencer equity and better delivery mechanisms to strip the market share right out from under big pharma and CPG.
It's more than a heist, Maya. It's a structural reconfiguration of how value is distributed. In consumer goods, the old agency-led advertising model is being bypassed by what Rohan Oza calls influence-the-influencer strategies. Instead of paying a massive fee to a middleman, new brands are moving directly to talent with equity-based deals.
Right, because equity-based partnerships is just a fancy way of saying we can't afford your upfront fee, so please take a slice of the pie instead.
The pattern is clear, it works. On Masters of Scale, Oza highlighted how he used an equity game to secure 50 Cent for vitamin water, creating a shared mission that eventually contributed to a $4.1 billion exit. You see the same pattern in the laddered strategy used by brands like Poppy, where they move from viral TikTok content to high-status visibility with names like Hailey Bieber.
So if you can't outspend them, you just make the celebrity your co-founder. But surely the biotech space is too regulated for that kind of vibes-based disruption.
The disruption there isn't about marketing, it's about solving the delivery bottleneck. While we've mastered identifying proteins to fix diseases like cystic fibrosis, the industry lacks the messaging capability to instruct cells throughout the body. The real frontier is in vivo therapy, moving away from expensive $750,000 ex vivo cell therapies that require months of manufacturing toward two-hour outpatient IV procedures.
Instead of organ entrapment where we can only treat the liver, we're looking at systemic utility.
As noted on the Tim Ferriss Show, the goal is infrastructure-compatible drug design, creating medicines that plug into existing infusion clinics rather than forcing doctors to learn entirely new workflows.
It sounds like a dream for the margins, even if the science is still catching up.
It's about maximizing intelligence utility. If AI can drive even a 10% reduction in cancer incidence, the economic gain is roughly $8 trillion.
Series A investors need to stop looking for the next blockbuster drug and start looking for the next better delivery system. Watch for the first major FDA approval of an in vivo RNA therapy that bypasses the need for specialized cell reprogramming labs. Looking back at everything we've covered today, the common thread isn't just technological change, but a fundamental reconfiguration of where value is actually captured. We are witnessing a move away from the pursuit of massive, headcount-heavy organizations toward the engineering of high-leverage autonomous systems. Whether it's the industrial bottlenecks in the hardware supply chain or the shift toward agentic commerce, the goal is no longer just to scale, but to build architectures that can orchestrate their own complexity.
And for the founders and operators in the room, the single most important implication is that your primary responsibility is shifting from managing people to managing dependencies. The calculus for CEO has changed. Success is no longer measured by how much capital you can deploy to acquire market share, but by how effectively you can integrate into the physical and digital bottlenecks, securing the energy, the silicon, and the automated workflows that others can't bypass. If you are building a company that requires constant manual oversight to function, you aren't building a scalable engine. You're just building a more expensive version of the legacy giants you're trying to disrupt.
It's about moving from being a creator of tasks to a designer of outcomes.
The data tells a story, so as we keep an eye on this transition, the specific signal to watch is the next major shift in API and data access policies from giants like SAP or Alibaba. If we see these incumbents move from open integration to walled garden restrictions, it will confirm that the era of easy software-led expansion is hitting a hard physical and political limit, forcing the next wave of startups to pivot even harder toward proprietary, vertically integrated infrastructure.
It's going to be a heavy climb. Thanks for joining us this Monday. We'll see you next week.